puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
Ah, yes, there's the music that heralds the arrival of Gordon Goldsboro of Abandoned Manitoba fame. Hi, Gordon.
Good morning, Laurie.
Now, what story do you have to tell us this week? And remind us of the clue from last week.
Yeah, well, I said last week that today we would be talking about a little pond in the middle of Delta Marsh that had some connection to the mechanization of Manitoba farms in the early 20th century.
Right. All right.
And the name of that little pond is Bone Pile Pond.
Oh, catchy.
Yeah, very evocative. Well, what it refers to is that at one time there was a mink farm operating nearby, and what they used as a source of food for those minks was horse meat.
Oh.
Horse meat, of course, the bones that they had left over, they simply piled up, and eventually they just got dumped into the pond, and hence the name, Bone Pile Pond.
Well, that's quite the visual.
Yes, right. Well, so there's an interesting story there. I mean, why, for example, did they use all this horse meat? Well, this is where we come into the story of the mechanization of farming, because, of course, at one time, horsepower meant that's how you got your farming done. You know, all of your equipment was pulled by horses. And at one time, well, in 1920, for example, Manitoba had over 300,000 horses, and one for every two Manitobans. So there was a lot of horses in Manitoba. But of course, as we began to use things like gasoline and diesel-powered equipment, we didn't need horses anymore, you know, because tractors now, they could run all day. You didn't need to feed them. You didn't need to rest them. They lasted years and years and years. They didn't wear out as fast. So, you know, it was really a revolution. And all these horses that had once been absolutely essential to farming, well, they didn't need them anymore.
And there was nowhere for them to go.
Well, that's right. So what do you do with all this unneeded horse?
Feed them to the minks.
So if we look at just for a moment at the fur industry here in Manitoba, of course, Manitoba was the center of the activity of the Hudson's Bay Company, you know, founded way, way back in 1670. And so for many, many years, they, of course, would purchase furs that had been trapped by Indigenous people. Well, as you get into the early 20th century, someone, I guess, had the bright idea that, you know, in addition to these wild furs, maybe you could actually grow wild animals in captivity and use that as a source of, you know, additional fur for coats and all the other things.
Fur farms.
Fur farms, exactly. So in 1920, there were exactly two farms here in Manitoba that specialized in growing fox. And that number would grow very rapidly, so that by the 1930s, it went from two farms up to 150 farms. So there were farms all over southern Manitoba. As an example of how these things would work, one of the farms I heard about in the RM of Hanover, for example, they had 100 female fox, and each female was in sort of a penned area. The idea being is that they would get a male fox, they would release the male into the female's pen, the farmer would watch and see if in fact mating took place, and mm-hmm. if it did, then the male got moved into the next pen. And if it didn't, he stayed in there until he did his duty.
Wow.
So the idea that this would all happen in the early part of the year, sort of January or February, the young foxes would be born in the spring. They had a very short life because by December of that same year, they would become a fur pelt.
Gee. So did this actually work?
Well, in fact, by the 1930s, it turned out they were starting to produce up to a third of the total fur supply was coming from these farms rather than from the trap lines of northern Manitoba. Like any kind of bred animal, you know, you could breed for high quality, you know, so they were looking for interesting coat colors so that, of course, that could translate into the clothing that was made from them. You know, it became a really big business. You know, I heard that, you know, by the 1920s, for example, a very good quality breeding male fox or breeding female fox could be worth $1,500. You know, and they had shows where they would bring these animals to, you know, show how high quality they were. So I think it was more that the wild animals, because they were from the wild, were kind of, you know, natural and variable, whereas these ones from these farms, you know, they could produce a very high quality, you know, and consistent product.
Control it.
Mm-hmm.
But unlike say, chickens, they don't eat corn.
That's right. Because, of course, unlike a lot of our domestic animals, cattle and chickens and so on, which are herbivores, and therefore you can feed them grain and hay and, you know, things like that, you know, fox and, well, mink were the other major animal they use here, too. They're carnivores.
Mm-hmm.
I came across a report from 1962 that said that the diet for mink at that time that they were feeding them in these farms, 30% of it was cereals, things like oatmeal and cracked wheat and cornmeal, but 70% of their diet was, in fact, meat. 10% of it was liver, 20% of it was fish, 20% of it was what they called packing house scraps, mm-hmm. I guess the leftovers after they've carved the meat that was going to be used in the domestic chain,
right.
And 20% of it was horse meat.
Wow.
Certainly back then, horse meat was one of the major ingredients. And I'd say because through the 1920s, 30s, 40s, you know, the only real time that the mechanization of farming really sort of slowed down was during the wars, during the Second World War especially, because they just didn't have the fuel and the raw materials to make the tractors. So then you saw a few horses coming back, but otherwise the number of horses waned. Say, so from a height, when I said before, a one for every two people, today there's only about 20% of the number of horses that there were a little over 80 years ago.
So was the rise of mink and fox farming, when it happened to hit this glut of horse meat, which made feeding them cheap, did it decline when the horses were phased out? What happened?
What happened was that things changed over the years. When we get into the 1960s, the 1970s, people's attitudes were changing, I think. Well, in fact, I'm told that the bottom really dropped out of the fox farming industry in 1987 because that was the year that the stock market crashed. It lost about a quarter of its value. And of course, when you lose all that value, you lose discretionary income for things like luxury goods, like, you know,
fur coats.
But, you know, that can't be the whole explanation, because if it was, well, we know that, of course, the economy has rebounded from that. And yet the fur industry, specifically the fur farmed industry, really hasn't rebounded to any significant extent. In fact, today there are no fur farms here in Manitoba, none at all. And in fact, I'm told all of our farmed fur actually comes from Scandinavia. So what I think that illustrates is that our attitudes about fur have changed, so that a lot of people today, even those who have the means, simply don't want to buy a fur because it's seen as sort of inhumane, that, mm-hmm. you know, the treatment of the animals, either whether they're trapped wild animals or whether they were farmed wild animals, it's just seen as, you know, cruel.
The market isn't there.
Just isn't there. So how does this all relate? Well, if we come back to those fur farms for a moment, you know, the farmer would, say, introduce the male fox into the pen with the female, and he would need to watch to make sure that successful breeding took place. Well, this is a hard thing to do when you've got, well, some of these farms, 100 females or more. That's a fairly expansive area. How can you see all that? Well, the key is you need to get up high. So on these fox farms, they would have a fox tower. And it was a fairly small building.
The poor foxes. I'm sure they were all repressed as anything. But anyway, yes.
Voyeurism, eh? Well, so this little building that they would have amongst these pens had a tower grafted onto it. It looked rather unusual, almost like sort of a periscope sticking out of a submarine going way up. And there was, at the top of this little tower, there was a little viewing platform. The farmer would sit up there watching the pens, watching that, you know, breeding took place, and then he could move them around. So even though the industry itself is gone, there are still, at least as far as I know, three of these fox towers still in existence. One of the ones that I found was near Stonewall. If anyone goes to one of the big berry farms there, they may have seen this building with this really tall tower. It's quite an unusual thing and might have wondered what the heck was this. It was a fox tower. In the Arm of Hanover, there was one. But the oldest one that I found so far anyway is just outside of Emerson, Manitoba. It was built in 1911. So it's one of the very earliest fox towers. The town there is trying to restore it as a historic artifact, because it is a sign, I think, of this time when we would farm wild animals for their fur.
Wow. I've heard of fox holes, but I'd never heard of fox towers. Just imagining the farmer up there you know, watching whether mating was taking
with his
place.
Binoculars, like, oh,
all around. Excuse me, did everything go all right?
Yep.
Okay, what about next week?
Well, next week we're going to visit a little one-room schoolhouse called Grainfields School. It's southeast of Roblin, Manitoba, and because of something the students and the teachers did when the school was in operation, made it extremely difficult for me to find the building when I went there 3 years ago.
Playing with matches, were they?
Well, we'll leave it until next week.
Thanks very much, Gordon.
You're welcome, Lori.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba. Many moons.